Horse Cave, Kentucky, November 1940. Long before he could hear the mournful wail of the locomotive whistle, the fuff-fuff-fuff-fuff-fuff-fuff of the steam engine belching towering clouds of black smoke and soot and cinders, the boy could see the Cyclops headlight winking far up the tracks. Pistons thundering, wheels clattering over the bobbing coal steel, it had rumbled through Shepherdsville and Elizabethtown, through Munfordville, across the Green River. Now it was rounding the curve and ringing its bell and hissing huge billows of steam as it approached the depot. As it did every day at 3 a.m., the Louisville and Nashville's old number 3, two cars and an engine, was bringing the world beyond to Horse Cave. Not the actual world beyond, correspondence from, accounts of the world beyond. The Day's Mail and the early edition of the Louisville Courier-Journal. Old number 3 didn't stop in Horse Cave. In the early morning chill, G.C. Holman, the station master, would stand on the wooden platform and snare the mail as the train eased past and a conductor kicked off the stack of papers, and then Bob Bristow, who was white, would kneel and unsnap his penknife and snip the rough brown twine that bit into the stack, and then he and a skinny, freckled white teenager would climb into his car and go deliver them. The other kid, who stood and watched and was not white, would deliver the rest, a couple of dozen perhaps. He'd make his rounds the same way he had gotten to the depot, on foot, with a smudged canvas paper bag slung over his thin shoulder. Half an hour earlier, he had climbed out of bed and slipped into his clothes, scuffed shoes, and headed out the front door. The house, four rooms made of rough, unfinished wood, sat on an embankment, its front yard sloping down to the shoulder of the old Dixie Highway. It had no indoor bathroom, but there was electricity and running water. And that was a big improvement over where they had lived until recently in a two-story building nearby that for years had been a dusty antique furniture refinishing shop. When the business moved and the structure converted into two apartments, he and his parents and brother Curtis, 3 years younger, and baby sister Shirley had moved in. Its only source of water was an outside spigot around to the side. But even that was a luxury compared to where they had lived with his grandma. Her house on McFerrin Street, just off the old Dixie Highway, had running water, but not the kind you wanted. It sat down in a bowl below the street level, and when the rain pelted the rusty tin roof, water ran right through the house, unless they dug little trenches along the front and sides. When the family needed running water, the boys had to run and get it. That meant climbing a steep hill to a spring nearly a mile away. Then came the slow trip back, the boy and his brother struggling to carry a number 2 tin lard can full, a smaller brimming bucket in the other hand to balance it. One hot summer day when they had paused where McFerrin and the old Dixie Highway met and gazed at the orchard next to the big white house with the miniature imitation plantation pillars, the boy had reached through the fence to pick up one of the hundreds of overripe apples and pears lying on the ground, their oozing sweet juice abuzz with bees. The woman who lived there, wild-eyed and pale, had jumped from behind a tree and smacked the back of the hand with a tobacco stick. "Get out of here, you dirty little nigger!" she had screamed. But it wasn't the lack of running water that had caused them to move from Grandma's into the old furniture refinishing building. Grandma had died, and a few days later, the white man who owned the house had knocked on the door and told them they'd have to move. That night, the boy's father had made a solemn vow. Never again would anyone, white or black, tell him and his family to go out. After each long day's work, while they lived in the old furniture refinishing building, Pud Wilson would build his own house, night after night, long after dark. Neighbors could hear the ring of Pud Wilson's hammer, the steady bite of his saw. A few months later, the little house, built of unfinished wood, was finished. Now this chilly November morning, the boy stuffed the newspapers into the bag and trudged across the tracks and up the hill to deliver them. Then he would head home for breakfast, bowl of cold beans and a piece of cornbread. After that, it'd be time to walk back downtown, back to the empty street to grind ice and sweep the floors at Mr. Wilson's drugstore and clean the post office and then go to school. Sometimes, as he worked, the boy could not help but think about the world beyond. Across the street stood the Owens Hotel. Old number 3 might not stop as it swept into town from and en route back into the world beyond, but the people who arrived by automobile often did. When they came to see nearby Mammoth Cave and the Hidden River Cave there in town, the Owens Hotel was where they stayed. Since 1859, when the railroad had come to town, there'd always been a hotel of some kind at that site, and the Owens, a 3-story brick and concrete structure with huge white pillars flanking its entrance, was the grandest of them all. They pulled up in Chevys and Fords and Studebakers and Packards and in sleek, shiny, chrome-glittering Cadillacs. And as he watched, he wondered about where they came from, those far-off places a million miles away that were really further away than that because they were in the world beyond, a world beyond anything he could imagine. Oh, sure, he'd been out of Horse Cave once a couple of years before he'd even ridden a passenger train clear to Bowling Green, 35 miles to the south. His mother had taken him and his younger brother, and the sole reason, as far as he could tell, was because she wanted them to know what it was like. And sometimes his father, who drove a delivery truck for the Moran Ice and Coal Company, would turn to him and say, "Come on, boy, go with me." And the chills would race up and down his spine as they rumbled out of town south to Glasgow to pick up a load of ice, or in the fall, southwest to Morgantown over in Butler County for a load of coal. Once he had even climbed aboard a Greyhound bus, spent his own money to do it, and ridden down US 31W to Cave City, 4 miles away, just so he would know what that was like. Someday, he'd get a job and buy a car and take trips down to Bowling Green, maybe even all the way to Louisville, 85 miles to the north. But now it was time to put away his dreams and head down Water Street and across the bottom to school. Down the street, another screen door slapped shut. The millionaire was headed to school, too. Actually, Carl Cecil Hellam was a wee bit short of $1 million, about $999,990 short, to be exact. But compared to the other black kids in Horse Cave, he sure felt like a millionaire. Unlike his second cousin, Clarence Wilson, Carl Cecil Hellam did not have to work before going to school. He lived with his uncle, Uncle Tone Barlow, and Aunt Lola. Uncle Tone had his own concrete finishing business, and weekends and summers he employed his nephew. As a result, Carl Cecil Hellam, like his uncle, always had money in his pocket. Why, he could go to a movie anytime he wanted to, buy popcorn and soda to boot, and if there was a girl at Horse Cave Colored who objected to helping him spend his money, Carl Cecil Hellam had not met her yet. Yes, sir, Carl Cecil Hellam felt like a millionaire. He sure did. Up ahead, he saw another figure crossing the bottoms. Old number 3 in the day's mail and newspapers and tourists in the bright, shiny cars weren't all that had come to Horse Cave from the world beyond. So had Newton Thomas.